Welcome to Under the Microscope, KBIA's weekly look at stories in health, science, and technology. I'm Christopher Husted. When we think of plants, intelligence is usually not the first thing that comes to mind. But maybe plants are more than just a decorative feature on our dining room tables and windowsills. KBIA's Marissa Ann Lewis-Thompson checked in with a monthly science conversation series in Columbia. This month's topic, the secret lives of plants.
On a recent Tuesday night, the sounds of restaurant chatter, music, and the aroma of food fill Columbia's Broadway Brewery. But in the middle of the crowd, sitting on a wooden stool, is an ordinary green plant.
There's an article in here by Michael Pollan on the intelligent plant.
Jack Schultz is the director of the Bond Life Sciences Center at MU. He led the evening's discussion on the thoughts of plants.
At an event like this, you at least have the opportunity to bring people close up with science and have a nice conversation about it. And the people who are not scientists are, after all, the people who pay for what scientists do, so I think it's only reasonable that they get an inside story, get an inside view of what we do.
Schultz Talk is part of the monthly Science Cafe Columbia event. Schultz, a plant scientist, began the evening by introducing his friend, the plant. Schultz says that just like humans, plants have the ability to move, but at a much slower pace. There are a number of biochemical mechanisms plants enact that the average person does not see. They even have smell and taste detectors.
They have to be really, really sensitive to everything that happens to them, everything that goes by. As a result, they're built to detect way more things than you and I can. For example, plants have the same kinds of smell and taste detectors that you and I have in our nose and mouth. But you and I only have about a dozen of those, and plants have over 600 of them.
Jason Cooley is a chemistry professor at MU. He says even he learned something about the similarities between how the bodies of both plants and humans communicate.
I was actually fairly intrigued to understand that plants produce a large portion of the chemicals that our own body uses to communicate with itself.
But Cooley wasn't the only person fascinated by plant intelligence. Erin Miller is a PhD student at MU. She says while the concept of animal intelligence has been covered extensively, scientists still have a lot to learn about plant intelligence.
I think this idea of intelligence of plants, it's a new way to think about intelligence, and it educates individuals on how their own intelligence works and how we might apply that to other species and how that might benefit the world as a whole.
Schultz agrees and says the true intelligence of a plant is often left in the shadows of human intelligence.
One of the reasons we're talking about this is to get people to give plants a little more credit and think a little more carefully about what they are, what they're like, and what they're doing. If you're going to do that, you have to ask questions about behavior and intelligence and thinking and so forth.
Schultz says there are still many mysteries left to uncover about the secret lives of plants, and helping people understand that plants are more complex than they think could help lead to more answers. Marissa Ann Lewis-Thompson, KBIA News.
University of Missouri researchers are starting to uncover details about how the brain adapts to the loss or impairment of an individual's dominant hand. Dr. Scott Fry with MU's Department of Psychological Sciences has been working with amputation and stroke patients, and his research may hold the secret to training the brain and the body to use a non-dominant hand. Fry recently sat down with KBIA's Jacob Jones.
What got you started with this research?
I began working with stroke patients who often have, as one of their more common difficulties, trouble using their hands. And one of the things that I became very interested in is how people compensate for loss of hand function on one side by being forced to use the other side. We looked at amputees as an example of just what can be achieved if one is forced to only use a single hand for years or even decades. And we focused our efforts on looking at amputees who had lost their right dominant hand, because these individuals provided a window into just what's possible in terms of compensating with a non-dominant hand. And we chose drawing because we had some ways to quantify drawing. We could have people draw on a digitizing tablet and record the speed and accuracy with which they performed. And I think a very exciting result that we obtained was that on average, our group of individuals who had lost their right dominant hand more than 20 years ago were performing as accurately and as quickly as right-handed individuals of similar age and similar gender. And I think that that's very telling, and it suggests that with enough practice, it's possible to have your non-dominant hand acquire these precision movement control that you normally have a big advantage with when you're performing with your dominant hand. The second part of the study was to ask, what are the brain mechanisms that are involved in this kind of compensation? And what we were able to show is that the areas that used to experience sensations coming in from that amputated right hand and that used to send signals out to control movements of that right hand began to serve the functions of that left hand. In other words, right-handed individuals forced to use the left hand for a long time were using not only the areas of the brain that receive sensory information from and control movements of that left hand, but were able to take advantage of the areas that used to be devoted to their dominant hand.
Is this something that stroke victims will be able to, with enough practice, use the opposite side of the brain to control their still functioning hand?
Another sort of interesting parallel here is that when stroke patients have an impairment of either hand, but gradually get the functions back into that hand, what we see is that it looks like they're using both sides of the brain. So in other words, very similar to our amputees who are compensating with their non-dominant hand, stroke patients, as the function comes back to that initially impaired hand, seem to start to use both sides somewhat as well.
What is the next step with this research?
We want to understand better how our finding might generalize to other behaviors, other functions of the hand. We also work with some people who are former amputees, individuals who have had a transplant of a hand. So there are only 50 or so of these individuals in the world now, but we're very privileged to have the opportunity to look at how their brains adapt and compensate.
Thanks for joining me for this week's Under the Microscope. Don't forget, you can find these stories and others featured on the show at kbia.org. I'm Christopher Husted. Thanks for listening.